Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the book they have written, are in the process of writing, or intend to write someday. My co-host for the program is Stone Payton, but he is off doing a remote today. At least that's what he said he was doing, but I imagine he is. What do you think, Andy?
There's no telling what Stone's off doing today. Since it's not sunny outside, chances are he is actually working.
Inside doing the remote.
Yeah, there's good odds on a rainy day. If it were sunny, I might question it.
Okay. Well, the voice you just heard is Andy Lowe, who is the strategy manager for Business Radio X, and he's working his way to being a vital cog at BRX, right? Or have you arrived?
Depends on who you ask and what day you ask.
Okay. Do you have your own show, by the way?
I've got a couple shows. I have Renegade Radio on Thursdays at noon, where we talk about revolutionary business topics, and then we have a new show, Executive Talk Radio, that is launching on Fridays, where we'll be talking to some of our business leaders here in the community. And, of course, I've been helping Steve Cadley out for a while with Atlanta Sales Talk Radio.
Okay, you are busy then, and you have established yourself as a vital cog. That's great. Well, last week we varied our format because of the show topic. We engaged in a general discussion the entire time. And I'm going to do that again, I hope. And I say I hope because my second guest hasn't shown up yet. So we're just going to have fun. We're going to have a general conversation anyway. Our topic is writing with passion about your own life, more than just a diary or a timeline. You know, many folks want to write about their life. They may call it a memoir or an autobiography or something like that. They want to talk about the lows and the highs, or some think about leaving a legacy for their children and grandchildren. Other folks simply want people to learn from their mistakes and successes, and it's a great idea. However, writing in a timeline fashion, I was born, I went to school, I graduated, I got a job, I struggled with, I overcame it by, is not going to generate a whole lot of interest, even among one's children and grandchildren, and certainly not the public. You know, you have to write with passion, which may include humor, as well as some painful recollections. And many folks believe they have poured their heart and soul on the paper, when in fact they really haven't. I've discovered over the years in working with clients that what they see in their minds as they write and what ultimately appears on the paper are not necessarily the same thing. So we're going to start with Dr. Shirley Garrett. She wrote A Tap Water Girl in a Bottle Water World. You know that's a tongue twister.
It is a tongue twister.
And the subtitle is Reflections on Belonging and Believing. And Dr. Shirley is a professional speaker, writer, and facilitator, and she works with organizations that want to create a new sense of spirit in the workplace and community, and with people who just simply want to rediscover what is really important in life. So I welcome you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here, Dr. Tim.
Well, I'm glad you're here. You were referred to me by Diane Bogino, who's the person we're hoping shows up, but I'm glad you came and you're here. I have read your book. You were gracious enough to send me a copy, and I actually devoured it. Would you tell our listeners briefly about your book? And I want to hear you say the title of it without getting twisted.
A Tap Water Girl in a Bottled Water World.
You did it.
It's kind of a rhythm you have to have when you say it. Mm-hmm. The book is about my life's journey. It's about the people who held my hand along the way. It's about the exciting things that happen and not so exciting or not so happy things. And yet it's a book full of promise. The subtitle is Reflections on Belonging and Believing. And I think that's what the book is really about. We all struggle to figure out where we belong in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just tapped into my journey of life and looked at places and situations that caused me to have a sense of believing and belonging.
What motivated you to write it?
Honestly, Tim, a couple of things happened. As a professional speaker, my clients often ask, Shirley, do you have a book?
Mm-hmm.
I was real cautious because I didn't want to write a book for the sake of having a book.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted a book that I could really feel very confident portrayed the kind of message that I wanted to portray. I wanted a book that people really wanted to read beyond the first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing stories, and that's what my book is. You know, as a professional speaker, often speakers write about concepts and ideas and six easy ways to do that and 12 steps mm-hmm. towards something. Well, yeah. I don't think I had any steps toward anything. So every time I sat down to write anything about my business or thoughts on communication, I always ended up doing it in a story form. Mm-hmm. That's my style. I wrote the book. The first story was actually the second story in the book, and I wrote it at the request of my mama. Our local newspaper was wanted people to write about memorable Christmases, mm-hmm. and my mama asked me to write about the Christmas that the first year that she and my daddy had adopted my sister and me, mm-hmm. and I wrote the story, and it was put in the newspaper, and it was picked up by not international press by any means, but I had some requests about that story from some other people, and it actually appeared in a Chicken Soup for the Soul book.
Oh, it did.
The interesting thing about my writing is that my mama was an English teacher. She should have been the one writing the story.
Oh, my.
And I was a physical education teacher, but it was first person, and it was based on not only my recollection, but also the family legend mm-hmm. of things that occurred during that period of time.
Ah. And you remembered it quite well, obviously.
Yes, uh-huh. I was blessed. Not everyone is blessed with a memory such mm-hmm. as mine. I think in families, often, there's one person who's the memory keeper.
Mm-hmm.
And in my family, I'm the memory keeper. My siblings don't have the vivid memory that I have, or they don't access it. I think that might be the key. I'm willing to access my memory and let it bubble up, if you will.
Oh, that triggers a thought for me in that I'm the youngest of three. My brother died a long time ago, though, so it's just my sister and me. But when we talk about things, and especially after our parents passed, we have totally different perspectives of life in that family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I finally came to under my my sister. How should we say? She was recalcitrant, mm-hmm. stubborn. Mm-hmm. My mom used different words than that, but we're on air. But I learned from Bonnie why she was the way she was, mm-hmm. and it all had to do with how she experienced the environment in our house and the culture around our mm-hmm. house, and we just both reacted different ways. So we have amazingly different memories.
Wow, that's interesting. My siblings and I have the same memories for the most part,
mm-hmm.
the big memories, you know, the decorations on the Christmas tree, the traditional memories, mm-hmm. the family patterns, things that we did on a regular basis, our history. What is different, and I think this is important, Tim, is that it's not so much that the experience is different, it's your reaction to it.
Exactly.
Because we're different emotional beings.
That's right. That's right. One of the things that struck me about reading your book you talk about being adopted and realizing, not so much you're going to be adopted, but realizing a portion of your life was closing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a poignant story. And one of the primary reasons I wanted to talk with you today was to help other people who are writing learn how to get in touch with that stuff. What was it like to write that story? Your eyes are watering as we speak, even though it happened a long time ago. Can you just share with us, please?
The story that Tim's referring to is a story where my birth mother leaves myself and my siblings in an orphanage. She had come to see us several times, but somehow that day I knew she was not going to come back. And as she left, that's a very vivid picture in my mind. So I think the answer to your question is that I placed myself in that experience. I let myself be fully in an experience when I write about it,
mm-hmm.
whether it's standing in the orphanage, watching my birth mother walk away, turning and blowing me a kiss, or seeing my new mama for the first time,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you can, I actually let my emotions be the story. And I write from an emotional place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's funny because I'm asked to speak at a lot of different places, including first grade, second grade, third grade, wherever, you know, teachers are talking about stories. And when I talk to children and ask them about their favorite book, They'll tell me the name of the book, and then when I ask them how it makes them feel, they can tell me the feeling.
Oh, really?
Right. And I think most of us get too involved with the language, mm-hmm. vocabulary, trying to weave a story instead of experience a story.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion is to people who really want to write their story that they allow themselves to feel the story. That can be kind of challenging at times
mm-hmm.
because some of your stories are very sad. Everybody
Absolutely.
Has sad stories. Everybody has every, you know, this is what I believe that is that we all have our stories.
Absolutely.
And that the stories, our experience may be unique. My experience of being an orphan was unique.
Mm-hmm.
Not that unique, I find out as I speak about it. But the emotions that we experience are universal. And so if you can, people will relate to the emotions through you telling your experience.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like that. What people can't see because we're on radio is I'm scribbling notes down. These are educational opportunities for me as well. As I kind of alluded to in my opening comments, and I think I have it posted on the website for this, that what has happened with me and my clients is they've said, you know, I'm really going to put it out there. And most of them are women who have had abusive childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read their manuscripts, it just isn't there. And what I suggest is that they see it, but somehow it doesn't get down to their fingertips.
Right, right.
How do you overcome that?
Oh, good question. I do believe that writing is almost, let me think of the right word here. It's almost a meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a place where you go back. You let yourself let go. First of all, when you write, let me assure, well, you know this, and your listeners probably know this too, that what you first put down may not be what's eventually printed.
Exactly.
You've got to capture, but it's more important to capture the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, I've read a lot of books, being a writer, a lot of speakers and other people who write send mm-hmm. me their manuscripts and ask me to respond to them, and I'm always tickled to do that. But what often the stories are about, people write what somebody did to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like a reporter. Think of a reporter. This happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. Your story is not about what somebody did to you. Your story is about how you felt when it happened.
That is so powerful.
And what you choose to do with it. What you choose to do with it.
That's
your story.
That's the key. Well, I just saw bells and whistles go off mm-hmm. in my head. That's it. It's not what they did.
No.
It's what you felt.
And when we when we give the story as if somebody has done this to us,
mm-hmm.
then we position ourselves as a victim. And then as we overcome what we've done to them, what's been done to us, then we look like a hero.
Uh-huh.
We are not the victim.
Wow.
And we are not the hero. I think I've read both. I've read where people, their whole writing is about being victimized. And I have great respect for people who have had trauma in their life. I'm not trivializing that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're stuck, then in order to write for the public, and when I say for the public, that's almost for anybody else to read, including your children, your grandchildren, et cetera,
yeah.
then you cannot be the victim. What I think is a very good practice, and I use this quite a bit, is doing a lot of journaling.
Mm-hmm.
And the journal is not for publication. It's to
Absolutely.
Access. It's freewheeling.
Yeah.
It's letting things come to me. And I write. My sister, Mary, that's Southern for Mary. Mary has promised me that when she reads my journals after I'm gone away, that she will not share them with anybody because they're not public records.
Mm-hmm.
And she won't be offended about the things I wrote about her either.
You're making an assumption as to who goes first, right?
Right. I'm making an assumption.
Well, see, I journal every day as well, but I write in a shorthand. I call it Tim's Hebrew because the Hebrew language drops vowels. I don't use vowels when I write. And so you have to know exactly what I'm saying to be able to get in the flow and figure everything out. And so I don't worry too much, but I have this feeling one of my sons is going to decode it.
I'm afraid that texting has done that already.
Yeah,
you've been discovered.
Never thought about that. I want to go back to telling the story and not being a victim. And I have that image of, it's obviously poignant because it is for you. You could hear the click-clack of your mother's shoes going away. When you go into that, what all do you see?
In my mind, actually, I have a very strong visual picture of my birth mother. I see a four-year-old child. I see myself as a small child, not knowing who I am, not knowing what's going to happen. Fearful and at the same time hungry for my mama to come back and
sure.
to hug me, to give me another kiss, to take me home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what I see in my mind is the figure walking down the hallway with a long coat on that comes to about mid-calf and with small ankles in high heel shoes that were common in the 50s, mm-hmm, in the mid-50s, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. common now, too. And I can just see the image of that person walking away. And that image is very poignant and very real to me. So as I see that image, then I'm also experiencing what I felt as a four-year-old child. And so those two things come together, and I let myself literally just put my fingers on the keyboard and type that experience. When I first started writing my stories, I have to be honest with you, there was very little editing. They just flowed.
That's great.
Yet, as I read the book, I could have made stronger writing mm-hmm. by editing more. But
sure.
that's okay. There's some, and that's what I want for people to understand, is not to worry about, is this a great masterpiece?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is a masterpiece of your life, is what the
exactly.
masterpiece is. That's all it's intended to be.
Yeah. Well, see, when you and I talked by phone originally, and you had shared that story which you just shared, it triggered memories for me. I shared with you that I grew up in a town that there was an actual orphanage.
Right.
And the orphanage was connected with the church that I grew up in, and it was St. Paul's Orphans Home.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a blue bus, and the blue bus showed up every Sunday morning bringing the kids to church. And I've been in the orphanage... Excuse me, and it's no longer in existence as an orphanage, but I've been in the building, in the long hallway, and the marble floor, and I can hear the shoes clicking with mm-hmm. anybody. And so as you told your story, that took me back to my childhood and just being up there and playing with the kids and having friendships with them. And oddly enough, curiously enough, amazingly, I guess, is I'm Facebook friends with some of those today from way back when.
Wow.
And it was your writing, well, first you're telling the story and then reading the story and that writing that just triggered all of that.
I think, Tim, if I can, you make mm-hmm. a very good point there. I don't think we pay enough attention to the triggers in our life
mm-hmm.
and let ourselves savor those triggers and think about those memories and what is my story on that memory. I'll give you an example. I was writing an article for the newspaper, and it had something to do with Valentine's. And as I had written the article pretty mm-hmm, much. Mm-hmm. I was satisfied with the article. And yesterday I was driving, where often great ideas come to me
mm-hmm,
when
mm-hmm.
I'm driving, when my mind's not preoccupied too much with the driving.
There you
Whoops.
Go. Yeah, at least you're not texting,
and,
right?
All of a sudden, I had a flashback of when I was a junior high school physical education teacher of a Valentine card I had received from one of my students. And he had left the homemade Valentine on my desk, and on the front of it was a cutout heart that wasn't perfectly shaped. And when I opened it up in his handwritten scribble was the message, "You is my sweetheart."
Oh, my.
That was so real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I saw that again. So that was the great introduction for the story that I went back and added that into the story. what I'm saying is get the meat of the story down, get your feelings down. Later, you can go back and add, with writer coaches such as yourself or myself, add things that actually make the writing stronger.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't all have to come out the first shot. I was pretty lucky.
Yes, you were.
I know that. I know that now.
Yeah.
I realize that.
Well, see, my own experience in trying to get my stories down began, as I was sharing with you before the show, when I wrote, wound up writing letters to my sons. And when I actually began to write that, I got 50 pages into the manuscript and hit a brick wall. And there was just no way I could get beyond that brick wall. And what I realized finally, was I was writing a theological treatise. And I was referring to my seminary books and my class notes and everything. And my kids were 16 and 12 at the time of that. You know, it was one of those, what am I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And so I backed off, and I just started writing letters. Because I figured when one writes letters, you do not go back to your textbooks from college or graduate school. You don't look at your classroom notes. You just write. Go ahead.
I visited my aunt who has Alzheimer's. She's 92 years old. She's my Aunt Floris, and she's the last living aunt or uncle that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I just adored my Aunt Floris. And I was visiting her in Athens a few weeks ago, and I was trying to stimulate conversation with her that would trigger some of her own memories. And I knew that she and her oldest sister wrote letters to each other every Friday.
Oh, my.
And I asked her about writing letters to our aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I always like to write letters because writing a letter is like having a conversation and you get to do all the talking.
Oh, that's sweet.
I love that. And, you know, that is what you're doing with your sons, with these letters. You're having a conversation, and you're getting to do all the talking, but you're doing it in such a way that you know you're feeding into their interest. When we write a letter, we have someone very specific in mind that's reading that letter, so we're writing to them. So I think that could apply to even writing your stories. Who are you writing them for? Who do you expect to read them?
Mm-hmm.
And write with that person in mind.
That's great. And that's the standard.
It's kind a conversation.
It's a conversation. And when you write any book, you have to know to whom are you writing. You have to have that clear picture. But especially if you're doing a life story, if you will, or a memoir kind of thing. What I also liked about your writing is you use a lot of descriptions. I'll give you another example. A longtime friend of mine began to write his life story, and he's doing the timeline because that works for him, and it's just for his kids, and they'll understand, well, that's just Dad or that's Grandpa, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But he talked about going to school, grade school, and I wrote back and I said, was that a one-story or a two-story? Was it wood or was it brick?
Mm-hmm.
How was the walk to school? What was it like coming back? You know, just basic things that would enhance the story.
Mm-hmm.
And his response was, oh.
Oh.
And his subsequent writing has been just immensely improved and delightfully picturesque, should we say.
It becomes rich.
Yes, it does.
It becomes rich. And talking about the chronological writing, I'd like to address that because I did not write my book chronologically.
No, you did not.
What I did is I wrote stories as they came to me. The very first story was about the first Christmas after we had been adopted.
Mm-hmm.
The second story was about my Aunt Audie. And my Aunt Audie had salt and pepper shakers, matching sets. She had...
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like thousands when I had to dust them. But so I got the second story was about Aunt Audie. And kind of aside on that story, I was writing that story, and my husband was sitting in the room next to where I was writing, and I started laughing, just laughing out loud, thinking of this about Aunt Audie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you can't be laughing at your own stuff, can you?
Oh, yeah.
And of course I can. But
absolutely.
My point is, you should be so in the moment that if it's funny, you should feel that joy bubbling up in you. And reverse of that, feel that sadness, feel that fear. And then I wrote other stories that I thought were good stories. Mm-hmm. I like these stories. I write what I like to write. When I decided to put it into a book format, I sat down with a writer, another writer, and she read through my stories, and it was a very profound experience. She is a writing coach and has been very successful, and she said, "Shirley, you are a writer." So first of all, I needed the confidence from somebody to say that
wonderful.
I could write.
Yeah.
Then I took the story and I looked for the gaps. I just lined up the stories in the chronological order that I had written them, even though they weren't intended. I just lined them up in chronological order. And then I started looking for the gaps.
Mm.
One of the things that I find that a lot of writers do is they switch back and forth from times.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be in one time and then they'll start reflecting back on another time. You know, you need to do the reflection in a different story. It really can be complex for the reader. The idea is to help the reader have a very stress-free journey. They don't have to make the connections. One of the things I did is I made 10 copies of the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it to 10 different people. One was a English teacher at the university because my mama was a whole lot better at grammar than I was. PE teachers didn't have to know a lot of grammar back then. Now they do. I gave it to 2 women who were not from the South.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm so Southern, I wanted to make sure that non-Southerners could enjoy it. I gave it to a couple of people who did not know my life story, so they could not mentally fill in the gaps.
Okay.
I gave it to a male, even though my target audience was not men. It has become a very strong audience for my book. But the point here is they were able to tell me, I was asking them to read for where are the gaps. And one of the gaps, as you read in the book, my parents had a son named Lamar.
Yeah.
Who was 14 when they adopted us.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, or 2 or 3 of them, said, "What happened to Lamar?"
Exactly.
And it wasn't that I had intentionally left him out of the rest of the story, but our lives, he wasn't a part of all those experiences.
Well, he was 10 years older than
right.
you.
Right. Now, it's interesting because I have, for my second book, I have written a story about Lamar.
Yeah.
And because he had his own life journey, then I had to, you know, write that in. He had been married and divorced. And so I sent the story to him and asked him if that was okay with him. And I think that's important when you're writing a life story. It's not that you're going to sugarcoat people's character, but it's not your job to reveal other people's story.
That's true.
And
that's
some
true.
People, you know, those make for sensational, you know, Mama Dearest kind of things.
Oh, yes.
We don't need to be in that. That
no.
If that's what you're doing, then own it and say, I'm trying to get even with somebody. But if you're really to tell your experience, you can talk about the pain that your mother caused. You can talk about the disappointments you had in life. But if you're writing to attack someone else, it's never going to feel good. And it's not going to give you resolution. You must be able to have peace about your story.
Yeah. I'm smiling on several levels because I'm thinking I may want to take back my copy of letters that I just gave you, because you've done such a good job of describing how to write, and wow. My brother was 10 years older than I, and so I was just really getting to know him when he died.
Wow.
And that was really, I was 22 and he was 32.
Wow.
And that was really painful.
Mm-hmm.
We had just had amazing kinds of sharing the last time I'd seen him. And there's just that in there. And how do you become the messenger for other people and to share that? And that's part of what I tried to do in letters. Could you pick another story, maybe a little bit later on? When you were in high school, your dad was the principal. I have none in mind. I'm just to talk about the process of writing that and making sure again that you got the story down and not just reporting.
I think the story that comes to mind was even later. Probably the story about my first marriage not working out. How do you write that without causing the audience, the reader, to try to choose sides on who was right and who was wrong, and what role did I play, and without revealing things that don't need to be revealed in a book? Because let me assure you, everything in my life I've done is not in this book and not going to be in any book, and it doesn't need to be in any book.
Oh, okay? Well, let's talk about that later, off air, okay?
Off air. And so I had to, it was a more emotionally intense, because I had to revisit a period of my life that was painful in a different way.
Sure
was. It was painful in an adult way, as your brother's death was painful in an adult way. So the important thing is that you still honor your emotions and feel your emotions. And you also get pretty honest, because I think in that story that I haven't read in a while, I say that my contribution was that I married someone who I knew in my heart was not ready to get married.
Mm.
I have to take responsibility for my life.
Sure.
Now, you were talking about my high school years. My high school years, my daddy was the principal and my mama was the guidance counselor.
Boy, you were boxed in, weren't
that's
you?
That's an awkward place to be in life. Even though they were wonderful principal and guidance counselor, there was no hiding. Mm-hmm. And I was struggling with two separate things. One, I struggled with, I wanted my parents to think I was fabulous.
Well, yeah.
You know, and I think that even maybe more so because they had adopted me, and I just cannot say this enough. They never, ever made us feel like we were adopted children and owed them anything. But at 4 years old, I had enough sense to know that, well here's the deal. When your birth parents give you away, it takes you a long time to realize that that's not normal.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking if I ever misbehaved, my new parents would give me away.
They're going to give you away.
So that
as well.
Was a lot of my. So I was really a very well behaved child. But then I'm going through this time of high school where I really want to please my parents. I continue to want them to be proud of me, and yet it was time to rebel a little bit. It was time to.
Sure.
And with your mother looking over your shoulder as you're flirting with somebody in high school, or you're some boy coming to pick you up, and they've got to see the same person who paddled them a week before.
Oh, my.
You know, that didn't happen often. But it was just, I wanted to please too many people, and I just, and two, I wanted to be somebody that I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the kind of the prologue to the book. I wanted to be Nancy Malone. She was so cute and adorable and so self-confident. And I was just, you know, oh my gosh. My self-esteem was very low and I was awkward. I didn't have the confidence as a person just to take it all in stride. So I was very sensitive to very many things. I wore my heart on my sleeve during high school. And I wanted to be a part of a group. And then I resented that I wasn't a part of the group. And that yin and yang, and it's so interesting because as I've gotten together with my classmates since then, I left after high school and went away to college, then went away even farther to New Mexico to teach school, and then when I came back, I moved to another part. I grew up in Bartow County, was my high school years. So I've seen my classmates, and it's just been such a wonderful revelation that many of them felt just as awkward as I did. I just thought I was the only one.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was painful.
Oh, sure.
You know, but you know what? That's universal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a painful part of everybody's life.
And we all have to identify that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, you're triggering memories for me. My sister in particular would always say to me, "You do know that you're adopted." And I didn't want to believe her, but wasn't sure that I couldn't believe her, and so I said, well, at least I was chosen rather than forced on them, you know, and that was the best I could do as a kid. But there were those moments, and you know, that image kind of thing. My brother was a tremendous, tremendous athlete, state champion wrestler, all kinds of. My sister was so artistic and so popular, and then there was me, and I'm thinking, they're all going to be comparing me to Bonnie and to Bob, and I just want to be me, and that's a challenge.
But I think that your siblings felt the same way.
Oh, absolutely.
We all I don't know anybody who doesn't feel that way
mm-hmm.
at one point in their life, and that's what I'd say is your experience, the way you experienced it may be unique, but your story's universal. So what you do is you uncover the universal emotions and reveal them through your unique story.
There you go.
Then you've got something to read.
Yeah. How did you decide what all to put in your book, and how did you decide, or when did you decide, there may be several more One More stories, but I'm stopping now?
I decided I wanted, in February, I just had a few stories that I'd written over the years, and when I met with my writer friend, then I decided that I wanted to have a book out now.
Okay.
Finally, I thought, you know what? I'm going to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at the stories I had and then tried to fill in the gaps, not year by year by year, but periods of life, like the adoption year, the first Christmas had been written. I wanted to write about Aunt Audie. That was kind of my early childhood. She was a first grade teacher. And that led me into the story about my neighbors, the boys who live next door we grew up like brothers and sisters. And mm-hmm. so I tell that story. And then I told the story about, you know, then it was about high school, what high school felt like. And then I didn't write too much about college at mm-hmm. all. I didn't mm-hmm. write very much about college at all. And I wrote about my decision to move out to New Mexico mm-hmm. after high school and teach school. And then when I came home to Georgia and decided to buy a farm with my cousin. And so those stories just kind of evolved. And when I felt like I had enough stories for there to be meat,
mm-hmm.
then that was it. I sent those stories to my readers, and 4 out of my 10 readers told me that one story didn't fit.
Oh.
So it came out.
Well, that's
good. And that was it.
Yeah,
I didn't absolutely. Argue with them. And that's another thing. Be careful who you ask advice of.
Mm-hmm.
And when you decide they're the right person to get advice from, say thank you.
That too.
And
yeah.
use it. Don't defend. And if you're not going to use their advice, that's okay. You don't have to defend that. But you know, it's important that you choose well
mm-hmm.
who you let. It's not let read your manuscript, because I think you ought to let everybody, because it takes a lot of courage. And the more I'm still, after all this time, don't think that when I wrote this article for the newspaper yesterday that I didn't send it to 4 people to read and ask their opinion on. I still do that.
Mm-hmm.
I depend on that.
That's good. But you have to choose wisely. You got to make sure that
you're
not just going to have somebody write back and say, oh, this is great. I couldn't do that.
I choose people who like to read.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
I choose people who love to read, because they're pretty good evaluators of what's good to read.
Okay, that makes sense. All right. What advice would you give to other writers?
Wow.
That's pretty carte blanche.
That is pretty carte blanche.
Let's go with people who are business writers, because we focus on business leaders, mm-hmm. professionals, and entrepreneurs, and you're a public speaker, you're a professional speaker and writer. What do those people need to keep in mind? Because, you know, they may be thinking right now, yeah, I'm not getting into emotional stuff. I'm a business person. I'm writing about, well, there's emotion there, don't you
think? Let me assure you that if you want your book read, there better be stories in it. And if you're going to tell me a point and make a point in your book, then I want to know what happened when it didn't work, or what happened to cause you to know that this was an important, where you were,
mm-hmm.
what was the pain, what was going wrong, how this intervention, this point came about, and then who used it in some of their success stories. Give me some examples. If we're going to talk about having a difficult conversation, how do you have a difficult conversation? Well, talk about what happens when people avoid difficult conversations. Use very specific examples. you know, you can change the names to protect the innocent, but then give me the model for a good conversation, but sure. then show me how to use that model and translate it into everyday language.
That is powerful.
A story. It's. I just really believe in stories. Now, I also know in the business world that stories have become, in like, I'm not, parables. A lot of people mm-hmm. are using parables, mm-hmm. you know, who moved my cheese, there's hundreds of those.
Sure.
And they're great. If I want a principle that I'm really searching for, I think it's preference. I think it's personal preference for the readers. Explore which way it would work better, whether to incorporate the entire principles into a story. I think there's a book called Bounce that does that. The entire story is about bouncing back, and a guy has lost his job, and he meets a guy at the gym, and the guy at the gym teaches him how to overcome what's happened, and they do it through story mm-hmm. and their conversations, and that's the entire book. Great principles in that book, one I refer to quite frequently. And then there's other books that give you just the principles and then maybe some stories to, well, we were talking earlier about, I have to think a minute, who does that so well? Donna Satchel.
Oh, okay.
Donna does a great job in her book on Get Serious About Success. Mm-hmm. The whole book is not a story, one story. It's each principal has many stories and many personal stories around it and interviews that she's done with people and observations. But don't just tell me this works because you think it works.
Prove it.
And another thing.
You're in a really, roll. Keep going.
There's really
going.
Nothing that new.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, yes.
There's really not many things that new
mm-hmm.
concepts, but the way the concept is presented is what makes it new.
Sure.
So you can't, in your story, nobody else can tell your story. Nobody else can tell your interviews. Nobody else can tell your experience.
Exactly.
So if you're building the framework, the principles are like the skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to put, you know, the muscles on, and those are the principles. And then those are the kind of the meaty part of the principles. And then you put the flesh, and that's what makes it look good. That's what makes it feel good. That's what makes it come alive.
So what's your next book? And when's it coming out?
It's interesting. And my goal was to have it finished before on the 24th of December, but I didn't set that goal till November the 1st.
That's a challenge.
Needless to say, some things got in the way. And actually, I'm very close to being finished with it.
Oh, well, good.
And it's going to be other stories,
mm-hmm.
very similar, in that they're personal reflections of a Tapwater girl. And I would venture to say it's probably better written. I hope it is better written. And probably delve a little deeper.
Wow.
I did not really go deep,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Tapwater Girl. I told the stories, and I told them from an emotional place. I didn't go as deep as I would now, but that's been a few years, and I'm 60 sure. years old now. I can go deeper.
Wow. That's exciting, isn't it? I like that. I am embarrassed and excited. I've let the clock just tick away here. This is the longest interview I've done of any one person in the history of the show. You kept us captivated. That is wonderful.
Either that or talk too much.
No. We don't go that direction. So we need to know how people can be in touch with you to buy your book. And what's your contact information?
Okay, the best way to buy my book is to contact me directly. Besides, I get to keep more of the money you spend if you do that.
I understand that one.
And I can personalize it for you.
Sure.
Now, certainly you can buy it on the internet, mm-hmm. Used books, and for heaven's sakes, don't negate that. But the best way to reach me is by my email address, and I'm going to say it, and then I will spell it.
Good.
Dr. Cheryl, that stands for Dr. Shirley Garrett. It's kind of like Dr. Phil, Dr. Tim, mm-hmm. Dr. Mm-hmm. Cheryl, DrShirl, at ShirleyGarrett.com. SHirleyGarrett.com. So it's Dr. Cheryl at ShirleyGarrett.com, or send me a text at 770-823-8668.
She winked at me when she said that.
I did not, Tim.
Yes, you did.
It's Valentine's Day. That's the only reason.
And now she's blushing. Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Well, hey, the clock is on us. And I welcome your comments and suggestions about content and our guests. If you would like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. And just send us an email, and that would go to whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Thank you, Andy, for keeping the machine rolling and the mics on air.
You're so good on air, Dr. Tim. You make my job easy. I just get to sit back here and learn the whole time. So
well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And thank you, Dr. Shirley Garrett. One more time, your contact information.
Dr. Cheryl at shirleygarrett.com, 770-823-8668.
Great. Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services. And you can learn more about Right Choice Services at www.right, that's W-R-I-T-E, choiceservices.com. I hope you will join us next week, and I encourage you to tell your friends about the show. Send them an email. Invite them to listen live or to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at rightherewrightnow.businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business right here, right now.